It'll be 250 years next year since the US became independent from the Europeans, and now, around 250 years later, it looks like the Europeans are on their way to independence from the US. Or as our YouTube user Paul Bruyere wrote in a comment, "My gut feeling tells me Europe is becoming an adult now." Well, thanks for that. Yes, we do read your comments. Do keep them coming, please. Anyway, I think what we can all agree on is that Donald Trump is changing things every day, at home, but also abroad. He's changing the relationship between the US and its allies. Just this week, Germany tightened its travel advice for the US, warning its citizens after several people with German passports were arrested upon entry. And we'll get to that a bit later. And Trump is, of course, also changing the relationship between allies. Some Canadians are like, hey, let's become a member of the EU rather than the 51st state of the US. And here in the EU, a lot of eyes are on France and Germany. So that's what today's episode of DW Berlin Briefing is all about. Has the US given up on Western values? And why should anyone who cares about democracy be very interested in the relationship between Germany and France? And what has the Statue of Liberty got to do with all of this? I've got some great guests. Jacob Ross joins us today. You're with German Council on Foreign Relations and are an expert on all things France and Germany. And Max Hoffmann is here in the studio with me. Hello, Max.
Good morning.
Former Washington and Brussels correspondent. And you also interviewed Emmanuel Macron back in 2018. You can tell us about that. And then also you've got family ties in the U.S. and in France.
Yeah, especially in the U.S. Yeah, when you just said it's time for Europe to become an adult, I was thinking, okay, if Europe is becoming an adult, then maybe the U.S. are entering puberty at the moment.
Oh, God. They're going backwards like Benjamin Button. Yeah, so I want to start with a quick warm-up. Max, would you advise anyone with a German passport to travel to the US at the moment?
Well, you know, we had three cases, I think, over the past weeks where German citizens had trouble entering the United States. As far as we understand, those were based on misunderstandings, or at least that's what was said afterwards. There are so many German citizens entering the United States every day, so we shouldn't lose perspective, right? So 99.9% of Germans entering the United States won't have any problems, especially, and that's what the foreign ministry in Germany is stressing. You need to have your papers in order. It's still up to the border control whether you can enter or not. But you need to have everything in order and make sure you correctly state what your purpose is in the United States. And that seemed to be the problem with some of the German citizens. What's different, though, nowadays is, of course, first of all, there's a much bigger focus on these things because of the tightening of all those measures in the United States. And secondly, it seems that the border authorities are acting, you know, much stricter than in the past. It's not like, and I've often had that feeling when entering the United States with people who are not U.S. citizens. Sometimes it's hard to talk to those border authorities. You know, if they have one word that kind of triggers them, if I may say it that way, then that's game over. You know, it's not like a common sense thing where you say, oh, there's a misunderstanding here. Sorry, I didn't express myself correctly. Can we start from scratch here? I'm not here to work, for example. I'm here to visit family or friends or something. But it seems like right now, if you just say the wrong thing, then that's it, you know, very categorically.
I mean, they've always had these signs, and I remember going to the US, and at the airport I was quite shocked as a European entering the US, and they had that big sign, no jokes from this point. So, you know, it's not a surprise, and like you say, you then found yourself thinking, oh my God, if I say the wrong thing, but you would always find people who say, okay, madam, relax, it's fine, it's going to be fine.
Right.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah, sort of. You know, my dad is German. And so we used to travel to the United States quite a lot, and sometimes he would have to go to the back room and explain what the purpose was. So that was always part of that, and probably crossing a border is never a good place to joke, I would say. But yeah, they take it very, very seriously, and that's basically what the Germans are saying. You know, don't take this lightly. If you're planning on going to the United States, you need to make sure that everything is in order and you say the right things.
Yeah, but, you know, the fact that the Foreign Office feels here in Germany that they need to remind citizens that even if you've got all your papers in order, there's no guarantee that you might not end up being essentially kept in custody for several weeks, you know, just for carrying, as in the case of a Berlin tattoo artist, your tools, essentially, where the woman from Berlin said, OK, I just wanted to add something to the tattoo of a friend. And they said, no, we can't rule out that you're not here to work illegally. So, yes, atmosphere definitely has changed, right?
It appears. I haven't traveled to the States recently, but that is my reading as well. And basically what the foreign ministry is saying, take this, you know, take it seriously. This might, as you said, not just be, okay, you can't come into the country, but with you ending up for several weeks in some kind of detention facility. And that's not a nice thing, as all those Germans, three of them actually, that told their tale, or at least that we know about, have said afterwards and confirmed this is not a nice situation to be in. And I think just, you know, German authorities wanted to make sure that everybody is aware of that. But again, I just wanted to reiterate here, it's important to remember, it's really a very, very small fraction of Germans entering the United States every day.
Yeah. And Jacob, as a warm-up to you, could you remind us, why should anybody care about what's going on between France and Germany right now?
Well, maybe a good point to start is to point at the past 3 years when many observers, both in France and Germany, got the impression that really very little came out of the Franco-German relationship due to the lack of trust between the German Chancellor, still Chancellor Olaf Scholz, and the French President Emmanuel Macron. And that this did not only impact the bilateral relationship between France and Germany, but really led to a sense that Europe or the European Union in general was losing speed, was not finding any compromise and solutions to very urgent and pressing problems. We talked a lot these past 3 years about energy policy, but primarily about defense policy, the fact that aid to Ukraine, the European capability to defend itself, themselves from future Russian aggressions was not where it should have been, preparations. And this was all linked to the Franco-German relationship and the fact that really these heads of state and government seemed to not go along well with each other. We had the visit this Tuesday in Berlin of President Macron, who met with Chancellor Scholz with a press conference, and then a dinner with the soon-to-be Chancellor Friedrich Merz. And we really got the feeling out of that that there's huge expectations on the French side that things will get better under a Chancellor Friedrich Merz, that the Franco-German relationship will improve, that there will be room for maneuver, for new solutions, for new impetus for European integration, especially in defense, with all the new money from the German side pouring in. But yeah, that's essentially why I think that the broader public should be very keen on this Franco-German relationship and follow closely if indeed Chancellor Merz, once he is in office and has his own government, will be able to build a trusty relationship with President Macron, who, that's probably the last point, but very important one as well, has very little time left in office himself. It's only 1.5 years roughly before the French electoral cycle will pick up again.
A lot of important points there from you, Jacob. That is also something that we discussed in last week's episode. So you can go back and look at Friedrich Merz's plans for Europe if you want to, and we'll post that link in the show notes. But I want to talk about something that happened between France and the US this week. And I'm going to throw two names at you, Caroline Levitt and Raphael Glucksmann, Max.
Yeah, the French want the Statue of Liberty back.
Well, not all of France.
Could
but
take
he
some
does.
Time, you know, maybe not as long as bringing it to New York back then in the 19th century, but yep.
Let's talk about the history and everything. We want to please everybody who doesn't know who Raphael Glucksmann, that French politician, is. Let us just hear what he said, why that caused so much of a debate, shall I put it that way. He is a member of the European Parliament. He is the co-chair of a small left-wing French party, and he made headlines this week for this provocative call to bring the Statue of Liberty back to France. He said, we're going to play you the clip, but I'm going to tell you what he said first because we need to listen to it in the original French. There's a lot of applause there as well. You hear that. We're going to say to the Americans who have chosen to side with the tyrants, to the Americans who fired researchers for demanding scientific freedom, give us back the Statue of Liberty. We gave it to you as a gift, but apparently you despise it, so it will just be fine here at home with us. Let's listen to Raphael Glucksmann.
Et nous allons dire aux Américains qui ont choisi de basculer du côté des tyrans, aux Américains qui virent les chercheurs pour avoir fait preuve de liberté scientifique, d'abord, rendez-nous la statue de la liberté. On vous en a fait cadeau. On vous en a fait cadeau. Mais apparemment, vous la méprisez. Alors elle sera très bien ici, chez nous.
So that was picked up then in the US by a reporter in the White House press room who asked Donald Trump's press secretary about this very comment. Let's listen to that.
There is now a member of the European Parliament from France who does not think the U.S. represents the values of the Statue of Liberty anymore. They want the Statue of Liberty back. So is President Trump going to send the Statue of Liberty back to France?
Absolutely not. And my advice to that unnamed low-level French politician would be to remind them that it's only because of the United States of America that the French are not speaking German right now. So they should be very grateful to our great country.
But that was then not the end of the story, because Raphael Glucksmann posted a very long thread essentially outlining that despite all the laughter, all the, you know, the jubilant response, there was a serious reason for him to make this comment. And let's just look at what he posted. He said, "No one, of course, will come and steal the Statue of Liberty. The statue is yours, but what it embodies belongs to everyone. And if the free world no longer interests your government, then we will take up the torch here in Europe." So, Jacob, very strong words. And of course, Glucksmann doesn't speak for all of France. But can you talk to us about that that seismic shift and the shockwaves that Donald Trump's policies at home, but also abroad, that seismic shift that is being felt here in Europe?
Well, to me, Glucksmann's remarks on the Statue of Liberty are, in a sense, a direct response to J.D. Vance's comments at the Munich Security Conference when he really got into the European discussions and during the German electoral campaign, really, and when he was basically telling the Europeans that they had betrayed the moral and ethics of Western liberal democracies, that they were suppressing free speech. And now Glucksmann is kind of turning this argument against the Trump administration, telling them that they indeed are the threat to democracies and the very Western liberal values that have been at the bedrock and the basis of the transatlantic relationship of the post-World War II liberal world order. To me, it's also, to put this in context, Glucksmann speaking to a domestic audience. I mean, he's scoring points with French voters, with his followers. So, he's definitely not speaking for France or for Europe, but I think he's an important voice, at least in the debate. And I think the fact that his remarks went viral and the response by the press secretary in the US also shows that there's still a sense of common and shared history. The fact that she replied with, the US landing on French beaches during World War II, liberating France from the Nazi German oppression, is also showing that there's still a very close bond, a transatlantic bond, linked to a shared history. And that became very clear. And that's my last point. When J.D. Vance came to Paris in February for the Artificial Intelligence Summit, and the French really tried to charm him by inviting him to the Hôtel des Invalides, to a very historical site in the heart of Paris, and showed him the sword of General Lafayette, who's a very important figure, as many will know, both in France, but also in the US, where many places and big streets are named after this French general who was crucial in the US war for independence. So again, I think we should not overestimate these remarks, and we should also see the risks that we are too focused on these kinds of exchanges while much more important things are happening in the US and probably in Europe as well. But still, I mean, I think that the reaction and the virality of these videos show that there is still very much a shared sense of history between the US and Europe, even though we are fighting about the exact interpretation of this shared history.
Hi, I'm Kate Laycock, host of DW's weekly European Current Affairs programme, Inside Europe. Our correspondents were there when the Berlin Wall fell, when the Balkans Wars broke out, and when Britain voted to leave the European Union. Now the continent is changing again, and we're rising to the challenge, bringing you a combination of expert analysis and on-the-ground reporting. Join us every Thursday.
Max.
Yeah, I wouldn't go that far, Jacob. But I completely hear where you're coming from, but I'm not sure it's really a sign of the shared history that's obviously there. It's more to try to get the narrative here. And you could say, yeah, it's a PR stunt, and it is sort of a PR stunt. Nobody believes the Statue of Liberty is really going to go back to France. Where are they going to put it anyway? But but the thing is,
that's already a narrative. Statue in Paris as well.
Yeah. Normandy.
The small one on the Seine.
Right.
The narrative here is, and that's what J.D. Vance said in Munich, and he said it when Zelensky was in Washington, is you guys should be grateful. You know, we did all this for free, and you reaped all the benefits. You're free riders, and we just did that because we're really, really nice people. Of course, that's baloney, you know, to put it that way. There's no other country in the world probably that profited as much from the free world order, from a rules-based society, from free trade as the United States. And that's kind of what kills me, really, in all this whole discussion is most economists will tell you that the country that will probably suffer at least among the most in the near future, but in the years to come, if Donald Trump continues with this economic policy, continues with no longer providing security, which was also sort of a, you know, not just a business, but ensured that free trade worked and was also one reason why countries decided to do business with the United States, because the United States was able to guarantee the security you need for free trade. And who profits from that? You know, who reaped the benefits? If you don't have a very narrow transactional view, the United States. And so in the end, all of this might hurt the wallets and the retirement funds of the people in the United States more than anybody else. And we said before, yeah, Europe is becoming an adult, and there might be something really good coming out of this for the Europeans in the end, because it is important to be able to guarantee your own security. It is important to be able to stand on your own two feet. And so that might be a positive outcome for the Europeans. But it's hard to see at the moment how this turns out. Well, you know, just economically speaking, I'm not even talking about reputation, for the citizens of the United States.
But if I might reply quickly, I think that one factor that has been overseen in Europe largely with regards to people like J.D. Vance, but also Pete Hegseth, the new Minister of Defense. And also Tulsi Gabbard, the new coordinator for national intelligence agencies. These are all millennials who were basically socialized and politicized these past 20 years in the global war on terror. And they have a deeply entrenched sense that foreign policy, security policy elites in Washington failed the American people in this global war on terror, that they spoiled billions in, you know, costs for foreign intervention, sending American troops to Afghanistan first, then to Iraq second. I mean, J.D. Vance served in Iraq for 6 months. He didn't see any combat, but still, I think it's a very important factor that is often overseen in the European debate. And I think that we see to a certain degree in this Trump administration a populism that is very much fueled by this millennial sense that foreign policy establishments in Washington failed to basically come up with a positive vision for US foreign policy to the world, and that they now probably overreact. I would completely agree with Max there that the US is definitely hurting its own interests right now in retreating in such a brutal way. But I think it's important still to pay some attention to the personal biographies of many of these people who are now pushing for this isolationist and very American-centered America First policy in the new Trump administration.
Max, do you want to give us a bit of context still about that Statue of Liberty? Because I do believe that it is something where people need to know the facts. I mean, Germany and France, for example, have come a long way. Where were they when France gave the Statue of Liberty to the US? Why did it give it? So
everybody knows Nina gave me a heads up before that I had to do my history lesson.
Yeah, this is not a history podcast, but context is important.
1886.
Thank you.
The Statue of Liberty was officially dedicated, was my understanding is, was there, right? Fully built, because it had to get there in several parts, because it's much, much bigger than the one that's still in Paris, which is really small. And 1886, France had just come out of the French Empire. The Germans had an emperor, a Kaiser back then, and the U.S. had already had a democracy for over 100 years, had officially abolished slavery. Of course, we all know that, you know, the real change came in the 1960s, but still, it symbolized what, you know, a lot of the things that what the West came to stand for many, not for all, that has to be clear. Freedom, freedom of expression, the rule of law, democracy, all those things. And so it's really a symbol, and it was always, you just imagine all those immigrants coming in the 19th and 20th century to New York, to Ellis Island, and, you know, they saw that on those boats. That was for them. When they saw that, they knew, this is the promised country. This is where we want to go, because we know we have a shot at happiness and fulfilling our destinies. And so it's a very, very strong symbol for what many people throughout, you know, the centuries even thought was great about America, was great about the U.S. And I think that's really one of the most fundamental shifts right now. The Trump administration does not stand for this anymore, does not represent this anymore. Of course, and that's also a part of the perspective. This administration has been in office for, you know, not very long, a couple of weeks, more than a couple of weeks, but really a very, very short time. Compared with the amount of history that we're talking about here, it's just a blink of an eye. Yeah, so America may very well stand for those values again. Let's not forget that.
And what many people here in Europe are saying, of course, the writing was on the wall when Donald Trump, it's his second term in office now. But the Europeans at the time, you know, the famous wake-up call, that was just not heard. I mean, you know, people here are acting surprised. And sometimes you think, why didn't they listen to Emmanuel Macron? If Jacob, you can remind us that Emmanuel Macron here in Europe was definitely the one person who reacted already during Donald Trump's first presidency and said, look, we need strategic autonomy. You know, this doesn't have to be an emotional topic. This is something where we Europeans now can also see this as an opportunity to say to the US, okay, we understand you're pivoting away from Europe towards Asia. We need to look after ourselves. And what was the reaction at the time, Jacob?
Well, I mean, it's, I think, very good to remind listeners that Macron, when he first got elected in 2017, was kind of breaching a trend that had been upon Europe and the West, really, for months. He came in after Brexit happened in the summer of 2016, and then Donald Trump got his first electoral victory in November 2016. And then many people expected Marine Le Pen to win the presidential elections in May 2017. But no, Macron won this election, and he won these elections with a very pro-European and optimistic program, basically, and electoral campaign, which surprised many people that elections were still winnable with these kinds of ideas. He then made a very strong argument for deeper European integration. Most will remember his Sorbonne speech in September 2017, when he was calling his European partners to further integration and to build this strategic autonomy or strategic sovereignty for Europeans, not only the European Union at the time already, but Europeans really. And he knew in this context, or he hoped, that Angela Merkel, at the time German Chancellor, would be at his side, since Merkel, only days basically after Macron had been elected, was coming back from her first meeting with President Trump in a G20 G8 or G7 context, and she was telling Germans in a famous speech, the so-called beer tent speech in Bavaria, that Germany could no longer rely upon the United States as allies. So very much similar to what Friedrich Merz said on election night on German TV, which surprised many, but we had the same situation basically in 2017, which again led to some optimism in Paris that the Germans would now be open to this historical, traditional French position that Europe should be capable of defending itself, should build a greater sovereignty. But these hopes were betrayed, and the sentiment in Paris still is that neither Angela Merkel nor her successor Olaf Scholz really replied to Emmanuel Macron's ideas, that they both didn't really commit to these French ideas, and that Olaf Scholz especially really fell back to a very traditional German foreign policy tradition or position, to be very close to the White House, to always coordinate with the American president before taking important decisions. And now we are finally in a position that the French have the feeling that we are back in 2017, only that this time the German chancellor, or soon to be chancellor, Friedrich Merz, is much more realistic, so to say, than Angela Merkel or Olaf Scholz with regards to what the Americans still want to do and can do in the transatlantic partnership.
Yeah, I mean, we've already talked about the fact that Emmanuel Macron, when he was here in Berlin this week, that he actually spent a lot of time with Friedrich Merz, knowing that his hopes are now lying on the soon-to-be chancellor. We've also got a picture of Friedrich Merz in Paris. So Friedrich Merz is really trying to reach out to Emmanuel Macron. Let us just talk about the differences and the similarities in style between these two people. Max, you interviewed Emmanuel Macron in 2018. You've obviously watched him over those years. You've also now got a glimpse of Friedrich Merz, who, we have to remind everybody, is sort of a newbie again on the political stage. So he doesn't have any experience in executive power. That is something, you know, where some people are saying, all right, well, he's a bit unpredictable, but so is Emmanuel Macron, right?
I mean, they have a couple of things in common, and Jacob knows this just as well as I do. You know, they both spent some time in the business world, haven't been professional politicians, if you want to put it that way, all the time. Although Friedrich Merz, much, much longer. By the way, also something that connects him maybe to Donald Trump. We'll see. That's a card he could play. Both are pretty emotional, I would say. So the differences between... Sorry, I'm laughing here, but I'm just picturing Emmanuel Macron back then with Angela Merkel, you know, who was.
But they did get on towards the end.
They got along, yeah, but they were very different. Angela Merkel usually did not display her emotions very clearly, but she
except
had very,
for football.
Except for soccer, as we would say in the United States.
Sorry,
that's okay. And she still has, by the way, a very fine sense of humor, of course, and if you knew how to read that, but they were very different. And it was frustrating for Emmanuel Macron back then because, you know, she wouldn't really tag along. She was very critical. She wasn't, you know, she wouldn't, just because somebody was able to give a good speech, that didn't mean she was going to reverse course of the whole country. Did the same thing, for example, when Barack Obama requested to speak in front of the Brandenburg Gate, if you remember that here in Berlin. She was also like, let him do something first before we, you know, before we're all so excited. And in the end, they got along really well, too. I mean, he was there when he promoted her book and everything. Anyway, I'm getting off topic, going down a rabbit hole here, but yes, I agree. Macron and Merz might be more similar in that sense. And you could tell Macron is jumping on the opportunity, like somebody who starved in the desert and suddenly sees some water.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean, though, that everything the German chancellors like Olaf Scholz or Angela Merkel did in the past was complete nonsense. You have to look at the fine print. You know, if you want to go and use the French nuclear umbrella, who decides when those nuclear arms are deployed? Now, the French aren't going to say, okay, the Germans can decide now. So that's tough. Second one.
Would take too long for the Germans to decide who in Germany would press up on?
Maybe, maybe not. You know, Germans are changing there. But the second thing is money. It's always about money in the end. You know, with the Trump, it's a bit, don't make no mistake. For the French, it's also about money, because one of the goals of Emmanuel Macron in the past has always been euro bonds. So basically have European debt. I'm seeing the Germans as the biggest economy in the European Union has always rejected, because they would be in for it. And that was understandable. That was the will of the voters as well. But new times might require new measures. So it's very envisionable, at least, or we can imagine that Metz will change that, because he spent his time, and that brings me back to what I said in the beginning, he spent his time in the financial world. So he might not, you know, he might have a be more comfortable with those financial instruments that make the world go around nowadays. That's just the way it is.
And his supporters, of course, are saying he's a pragmatist, so he reacts to new realities, and he is very ready to take risks. And we've seen that he's not even in office, and yet this week we've seen that he pushed through Bundestag, this huge package, essentially a 180-degree turnaround on this German belief in strict fiscal policy, surprising everyone. And of course, his critics are now saying, well, you broke your word. So it's a very, very fine line, and it'll be interesting to watch how he behaves.
But you know, I'm sorry to interrupt, Nina. One more thing that I think brings Macron and Metz together a bit, or where they're a little similar, at least in my personal opinion, you know, is Metz, if you agree with him or not, okay, but Metz knows how to give a good speech. Mm. Right. And that's also something that sets him apart from, many would say, OK, from Olaf Scholz, for example, who was very dry. And even Angela Merkel wasn't known to be a really good speechmaker or something. Mm. Like. But he's someone who's, he knows his way around speeches, definitely.
And not just him, also Boris Pistorius, the German defense minister. Sorry, Jacob, just wanted to mention, because I don't think it's a well-known fact. Boris Pistorius is completely fluent in French. He's Germany's defense minister, also extremely good at giving speeches. And, you know, he has a problem that he's got a political party behind him where not everybody is as keen as he is to, you know, invest a lot more in arming Ukraine, for example. So that will be interesting, that dynamic as well. And Boris Pistorius actually calls the French defense minister a very close friend and gave a speech. I was there in Paris where he spoke for 40 minutes in fluent French. So, yeah, Jacob, sorry, your thoughts on Macron and Merz.
No, yes, I would agree with what Max said. In the end, it will be about money and the fact that Merz took this huge political risk now, which is also a huge opportunity, sure, but also a very big risk of loosening the debt brake and basically, I mean, betraying what he said prior to the election. And you could see this will to take big risks to get big things done, that is very typical of Macron's style ever since he got elected first in 2017. Many people say that it's now, I mean, his chancellery will be starting with an all-in move, because many people say that if the extreme right in Germany, AfD, can convince the German public that Merz indeed broke his word and is now, you know, opening the floodgates and really indebting Germany, maybe also giving in to these traditional French demands to come up with euro bonds to finance European investment, especially in defense, through taxpayer guarantees, which are in the end secured by German voters, that the AfD might gain a very potent political weapon going forward. We might remind your listeners as well that the AfD was not, in its founding time, a party that was mainly opposed to immigration or interior security topics, were not the primary topics for this party, but the euro, the safeguarding of Greece, keeping Greece in the eurozone, that was the initial raison d'etre of the AfD when it was founded in 2013, back in 2013. And Merz is now risking of giving this topic back to this party and strengthening it further. But he is also gaining room for maneuver to push forward European integration, to strengthen German defense, investment in Germany. And Macron is definitely, and the French are definitely hoping that some of this money will benefit European companies, French companies, in a situation where France really has very little room, fiscal room for maneuver. You know, I mean, France needs to invest a lot of money, but the French debt are at a level that leaves very little room. So yes, I think that's
risky.
Big hope in Paris right now. It is risky, yes.
Yeah, and you just mentioned the AFD. I just want to remind everybody we've done a couple of episodes on them. That was prior to the elections here, so we'll put those links in the show notes. You know, the key players in the party, where have they come from, where are they now, etc., all those things. And if you want to go back, just, you know, watch that episode. Also, we're talking about that big debt package, and we have a DW Berlin Briefing newsletter that comes out every week, and we've got all the details in there. So make sure that you subscribe. We'll put the link in the show notes as well. And we do need to talk about populism, though, because Jacob, I think at the very beginning, talked about this very, very short window. It's a very small window that France and Germany have now. Friedrich Merz will come into office at some point in April. We're expecting that anyway. And the French are going to the polls again to elect a new president in 2027. So effectively, we've got a year and a half. Now, I'd like to end this episode with that question. Will they seize those 1.5 years to make sure that the Europeans find a way of, you know, keeping democracy going strongly and keeping the populist parties on the fringes at bay?
I'm not sure I agree with the definition of keeping democracy going, you know, because in the end, electing who you want to, voting for who you want to vote, who's on the ballot, even if, you know, it's the AFD or Marine Le Pen or something, is democracy too. What those people do with liberal democracy then is a different story. Back to your question. Will they seize the moment? There's definitely momentum like I have never seen before when it comes to arming Europe, trying to coordinate better between all those member states, how they should buy arms, how they should coordinate among themselves. I cannot stress enough how complicated that already is for one country. Now, if you have the whole European Union, it's a monumental task. But they've heard that, and they are trying to do something about it. Not every EU member is going to be on board, so it's going to be, will have to be some sort of coalition of the willing. The point I'm trying to make is, most military experts, and I'm not a military expert, but say you need 10 years to be ready to defend Europe with the capabilities that the Europeans have right now. 10 years. A lot of things can happen in 10 years. It's not just about the French electing a new president in about two years. We'll have a new German election. We'll have a new U.S. election. Who knows what's coming out of there? If you have a Democrat who's super pro-Euro-pro transatlantic relationships coming in, then that might have some effect on the momentum. Everybody might say again, oh, okay, yeah. Trump's gone, fine, we're fine. We're fine again, nothing will happen. And then AFD might, you know, you never know, might
there
be part
might be
of a German government.
In Ukraine.
You don't know what the Russians do. So saying, will this momentum hold up? Will the Europeans stay as determined with this construction that is, after all, you know, has brought peace, but it is complicated? And that's really hard to say. It's impossible to predict.
That is not a very helpful answer.
I apologize.
No. I get where you're coming
from. But you know
from.
Who you should ask? You know, you didn't mention who was here this week and who might be able to give you an answer. The Clintons were here in Berlin.
Oh, yeah, we try to get them next time on our podcast.
They were
hopefully
here. And I was just wondering, when Bill Clinton met Olaf Scholz, so the German chancellor as of now, what did he tell him? Did he say, listen, Olaf, we know we're in a bad place right now for you guys, but America always did the right thing in the end. Things will change. Don't worry about it. You just have to kind of cross that gap. Or did he say, folks, this is really bad. It's not going to get better soon. You have to act. We don't know.
We'll ask him next time he's on our podcast. Jacob, are the Germans prepared enough for a scenario where Marine Le Pen wins the French presidential elections? Can you tell us a bit about, you know, are they reaching out to the Le Pen people in France?
No, they're not reaching out. And I mean, you see that even the relationship between the extreme rights, AfD and Rassemblement National in France, is at a low point. You know, they are not really cooperating in the European Parliament. So there's very little exchange. I think the German government, we as think tanks, as observers, are preparing for these scenarios, but I don't think we can be prepared for French President Marine Le Pen just as much. And I mean, that goes back to what Max said. Nobody really was prepared for the second Trump presidency, at least not for how brutal it would turn out since a couple of weeks now. What I would add, and maybe on a more optimistic note to end this, is that we are at the danger of getting paralyzed, you know, watching towards Washington.
That doesn't
saying,
sound very
okay,
optimistic.
How's that optimistic, Jacob?
It's the German definition of optimistic.
No, but I mean, we should move anyway. We can't wait. And I very much agree with Max. You know, if we try to predict what will be in 10 years in Europe, in the US, in Russia, you know, that would be impossible and it would leave us paralyzed. So I would say, as a younger millennial, let's seize the opportunity and get going and build a European defense, strengthen European sovereignty, which will be a good thing in any case. I mean, even if we get a pro-European, a transatlantic, traditional American president in 4 years again, would it hurt for Europeans to be more sovereign, more independent, more capable of defending themselves? I don't think so. And I see a big chance and opportunity for a younger generation to really renew the European integration process, something that President Macron has called for since 2017, but that now many other people will have to pick up after him.
Nothing to add here. So thank you very much for watching and listening wherever you are on all our podcast platforms, on YouTube, wherever you have found us. Make sure that you contribute to the conversation. You can send us comments. We're always looking forward to, and we're actually reading them. So tune in next time.